Opponents call it an environmental threat and a violation of private property rights. The Iowa Utilities Board just gave it the green light. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll find out why the green light for the Bakken oil pipeline may not be the final word. An update on the Medicaid transition to private management. The UNI Panthers win a berth to the NCAA tournament. How low commodity prices may lead farmers to new crops. And a new IPTV documentary about women in farming. And I talk with an Iowan who's working to bring an Afghan woman to Iowa to attend college. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to round off our week. Some news that we didn't get to, or some news in this case that just cropped up yesterday. A controversial underground pipeline to carry crude oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota across Iowa to Illinois has been unanimously approved by the Iowa Utilities Board. All three board members voted in favor. It's a pipeline that will run in Iowa, 346 miles, crossing 18 Iowa counties. Bill Petrosky of the Des Moines Register was at the meeting yesterday. He's been following this story. Bill, hello.
Good to talk with you, Ben.
So you were in the room. What was it like, the atmosphere, when the decision came down?
Well, there was a lot of anticipation. I think people ahead of time very much felt like it was going to be a decision in favor of the pipeline. People were wondering, was it going to be 3-0 or 2-1? But people really anticipated this because the board had really been laying the groundwork for this. They had been looking at conditions ahead of time, what they were going to do, what they're going to require the company to do in terms of how to build the pipeline, assurances to protect the environment, to protect property owners' rights, you know, come in and fix the land after they dig the trench to put the pipe in there. So from that perspective, I think it wasn't a surprise, but it was still a very tense environment. The chairwoman, Jerry Huser, made the announcement, called the meeting to order. There was just a very brief discussion. It only lasted about 7 minutes, and then she announced that the meeting was over, and then some people who were opposed to the pipeline, they began standing up and saying, "I'm an Iowan," and vote no. One by one, these people stood up and loudly proclaimed this, and she kind of gaveled the meeting to order and started to say, "You shouldn't do this," but then she just walked away, and then the board left the meeting room. So it was just a very brief thing.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, Bill, of the arguments against this pipeline.
Well, this is a situation that has really divided Iowans from many walks of life. A lot of people think that this is going to be a potential big economic benefit to the state. There's going to be almost $1 billion spent on this project. It's going to hire, I think, an estimated 2,000 to 4,000 people are going to be working on this, and it's supposed to all be built just this year. And, of course, people see it as a environmental threat. It's also seen as a violation of private property rights because they are going to use eminent domain to acquire land for this project. There's about almost 1,300 parcels of land, and in most cases the company has gone in and worked out a deal with property owners. We're really talking about mostly farmers here, and said, "Hey, we will give you some compensation. We will come back and fix your land. You can farm over it afterwards." But some farmers have said, "Hey, absolutely not," and they're going to battle this in court. And this case very well may, of eminent domain, very well may ultimately be decided by the Iowa Supreme Court.
Okay, so this is not the final word. What do you anticipate to be the next step by the opponents?
Well, there are going to be lawsuits. There will be lawsuits over eminent domain. The Iowa Sierra Club is going to challenge this decision, saying that it was not properly made. You're going to see people just continuing to protest it. I've had people who are opposed to it saying that you may see people laying down in front of bulldozers in an effort to stop it. On top of that, this company, Energy Transfer Partners, which is the parent of Dakota Access, it has, like a lot of other companies in the oil industry, It has seen its stock price plummet, and a lot of, you know, there's a lot of financial trouble in the oil industry, and a lot of people have speculated, you know, will this thing actually move forward? The company has repeatedly said yes, but I think some people are suggesting, well, maybe it might not, but as of right now, it's still definitely a go.
Right, and the background to that, I assume, is that when oil prices plummet the way they have over the past year, it makes such a project less viable because if there's cheaper crude elsewhere, why not get it there?
Absolutely right, and complicating that, this company, Energy Transfer Partners, which is a leading player in the industry, the owner of the company, Kelsey Warren, one of his companies, Energy Transfer Equity, has, I guess it was last fall, agreed to buy its rival Williams companies for about $38 billion, and that deal is now considered to be a nightmare. The New York Times had a big story about it a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. So back to the question of eminent domain that may
right.
be the legal case here. Eminent domain usually used by the government to expropriate private property for public use with payment of compensation. Now, this is a case where we have a private company doing this. Did the Utilities Board address that controversial aspect? Was that part of their decision?
Well, what their decision concluded was that this would still be overall in the public benefit, and that's exactly right. And I think that's going to be the key legal issue before the Iowa Supreme Court, assuming that this does go to the Iowa Supreme Court. This is not a public utility. This is a private company, and it's a private company. But I think the idea is that there are still public benefits, and the Utilities Board said the public benefits include significant safety advantages of transporting oil by pipeline compared with other alternatives. We're really particularly talking about railroad shipment of it. And other public benefits include the creation of jobs and other economic benefits projected to be at least $787 million during the construction period.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how much precedent there would be. Is there any precedent in Iowa or across the country for this sort of what you might say is widening the powers of eminent domain into the private sector?
Well, that's exactly right. And as you're aware, there's been a lot of debate all over the country about eminent domain, and this is something that has been addressed previously by the Iowa legislature, and there's been an effort to narrow the use of eminent domain. So this very well could be a precedent-setting case before the Iowa Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. So we have this project getting going very quickly within the next few weeks here, right, and to be completed by before the end of the year?
That's exactly right. I talked with somebody from one of the unions that would be involved in this project, and they told me they thought perhaps May, something like that. The company has said that it would like to be completed in later this year. I've seen some speculation that it might not be done until early 2017. So, you know, that's yet to be determined. But it is correct, though, that they want this entire thing to be built across four states in 1 year. So you can just imagine how massive of a project this would be. And I was talking with one union leader here a couple of weeks ago, and he said people really have no idea how big of a project this is going to be. Assuming that this moves forward, he said this will be like, you know how RAGBRAI has a huge impact on towns for just a day or two?
Mm-hmm.
He said this would be like having RAGBRAI come to a small town for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. He said this project will be moving across the state like an enormous slinky.
Now, how big is the diameter of the pipeline? That's several feet underground, right?
That's exactly right. We're talking about the pipeline. I can't remember the exact thing, but I think it's going to be buried something like 4 feet in farm fields, and you know it has to be separated from tile. But we're talking about the pipe is 30 inches in diameter, so that's a pretty big pipe.
Mm-hmm. About a yard in diameter. So. You mentioned requirements and assurances that were given that were named by the Utilities Board. I wonder, even if the opponents didn't stop this pipeline, if they their actions, if this goes through, did achieve something in the extra requirements and assurances?
Oh, absolutely. The actual order that that is was issued yesterday. It's about an inch thick. I think they said it's 175 pages. So there are many, many factors here. And the board was very, very careful in laying this project out. I think I mentioned in my story today that the board received more than 8,000 public comments, and they compiled more than 3,500 pages of transcripts. There was 18 public information meetings. There were 12 days of public hearings, and there were just weeks and weeks of deliberations on this project. And I think the reason for this is that they knew that this is going to be contested in court one way or another, and they really wanted to have, you know, all their I's dotted and all their T's crossed.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, back to the legal case and the construction, you said it is in the getty up and go phase here. It would seem they would be spurred to do the construction as fast as possible. How will that happen if the construction starts and then something happens on the legal front to stop it or stay it?
Well, I think that's a good question, and you probably need to talk with some real legal experts. Some of the lawyers that I've talked with, they have said that they think that the project probably would go ahead regardless of lawsuit.
Okay. Bill Petrosky, thank you very much for filling us in on the background of this news story, the controversial underground pipeline, the Bakken pipeline, given the go-ahead by the Iowa Utilities Board, a controversy going back to 2014 when it was plans for this pipeline were first announced. Bill Petrosky with the Des Moines Register, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new poll by the Des Moines Register and Mediacom shows that more than half of us Iowans would have more faith in the state's Medicaid program if it were state-run. Now, private management is set to go into effect on April 1st. That will affect more than 500,000 Iowans who receive some form of Medicaid. Tony Lays is a health reporter with the Des Moines Register. He joins me now. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
So what do you see in this poll about the divide over public opinion on the state's Medicaid program?
Well, a majority say that they would trust state government more to run the program. 55% feel that way. 36% would have more faith in a private company running it. There is a big partisan split here, which is probably not surprising. 78% of Democrats would trust the state government more to run it, and 59% of Republicans would trust private companies more.
Mm-hmm. Why did the Des Moines Register choose to ask these specific questions?
It was a way to get at how people feel about the change that's about to take place on April 1st.
Mm-hmm. So oversight has been a big part of the debate here. What kind of oversight measures there will be over this private management that's been talked about in the legislature. What is being considered now?
Well, there's a bill that the Senate passed that would have stronger oversight, including quite a few more ombudsmen for people to complain to if they have a problem with their new private plan. The governor has indicated that he doesn't think that that's necessary. He's called it overkill. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the House, mm-hmm. which the Republicans control.
Mm-hmm. Does it look like that will be a squabble between the Democrats and Republicans for a long time, or will they meet some compromise there?
Hard telling. It hasn't been settled yet, put it that way.
You also wrote connected to this story about plans for the wellness centers owned by these private companies that are taking over the state's Medicaid program. They're looking to open wellness centers. How are they part of the plan?
Well, it's not quite clear exactly what they would do. They don't look like there are going to be a whole lot of them. There's some concern that there will be a conflict of interest since it's the insurance company essentially would be running the clinic. But it'll be interesting to see exactly what they do. The details have not been released yet.
Mm-hmm. So the wellness centers would be funded by Medicaid dollars, or is this something else that you would sign up for?
Well, the companies are getting Medicaid dollars, and the basic idea is if they can keep people well and can keep them from using a lot of medical services because they get sick, then the companies make more profit. That's the theory behind this. So the supporters say that these centers would be to help folks stay well, especially if they have a chronic condition.
Mm-hmm. What other facets of this story are you keeping your eyes on for the future reporting?
Well, the big question is, now that it's finally going to be implemented on April 1st, what will people's experience really be? There's been a lot of speculation on both sides. Now we get to find out what's really going to happen. Mm-hmm. So we'll be keeping an eye on it. I think other folks will be too. And so certainly these companies and state government are going to be under the gun to show that this can work.
Tony Lays, health reporter for the Des Moines Register. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This weekend, we'll know which of Iowa's teams are playing in the NCAA tournament and where they'll be playing the first rounds. So far, the UNI Panthers are going after winning on a buzzer beater versus the University of Evansville.
Tied at 54. Panthers can hold it for the final shot of the game. Potential game winner right here. With 16 seconds to play, tied at 54. Winner goes to the NCAA tournament. The loser checks into Heartbreak Hotel. Washburn way out front. He's got Ballantyne on him. Three to shoot it. West pulls up for two. It is good! It is good! He made the shot!
An amazing ending to that show. As you can hear, the Panthers going to the NCAA tournament. No lack of enthusiasm there. Adam Jacoby, managing editor of the blog blackheartgoldpants.com. Adam, welcome to the program. We're going to relegate your Hawks to the third position in this little roundup because they just haven't been playing up to it lately. Let's start with those Panthers winning their way to a second NCAA tournament berth by defeating the first and second seeds in this Missouri Valley Conference back-to-back.
Yeah, nobody can say that you and I didn't deserve this trip back to the NCAA tournament. They probably weren't going to make it without winning Missouri Valley Conference tournament, which has probably my favorite nickname of all the conference tournaments. They call it Arch Madness because it's in St. Louis, which is okay. Just a little slice of perfection. But they took on the best that the Missouri Valley has to offer. They beat both of them back to back, and I'm happy to see them rejoin the ranks of the NCAA tournament.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about their team. We heard, Wes Washburn is a big part of it. What else is going on there that makes them such a winner?
Well, you know, they're very well coached by Ben Jacobson, and they lost a lot of talent over the last couple of years, and everybody was sort of expecting them to, not necessarily have a terrible season, but to certainly backslide a little bit. Washburn has finally emerged as the go-to guy on this team after being a key, let's say, second or third contributor. If you want more of the homegrown guys, they've also got a big man named Bennett Koch, who's been a whole lot fun to watch. Wyatt Lowhouse, who Iowa fans are going to recognize that last name from Brad Lowhouse, the former Hawkeye. A whole lot of players who have come through the ranks in the Iowa high school system. So a lot of homegrown talent, and they play a quintessentially Missouri Valley style of ball, which is, just ball control, great shooting, not necessarily pounding the boards or anything like that, but they don't make a whole lot of mistakes. They don't try to run you off the floor. They just play good, solid, fundamental basketball.
The ISU Cyclones had good reason to have high expectations for this year's team, even without head coach Fred Hoiberg. They won last year's Big 12 tournament. They were a third seed in last year's NCAA tournament. Four returning starters. So what has happened with them this year?
Well, they really took a hit when Naz Mitrum-Long went out after eight games with an injury that cost him the season. He was one of the returning starters. And with that, their depth just wasn't the same. So between that and the fact that they're playing in a 2016 Big 12 that is not only the toughest college basketball conference this year, but probably the toughest conference the sport has seen in the last decade or more. Mm-hmm. That it is just full of excellent teams this year. They've got three teams in the top 10, including Kansas, who is one of the favorites to win the whole thing, and who just locked up, I want to say, their 12th straight, at least a share of the Big 12 title. They won it outright this year. But you look at their 10-8 conference record, and you're like, well, what the heck happened? Well, they're playing in an excellent league, and going over 500 in a Big 12 like that is a major accomplishment. So even though you see them with a record of 21-11, which is closer to Iowa's record than anything, they're still slotted as a four, maybe a five, probably a five seed in most of the bracket projections at this point, which is not too bad. And if you're a five seed and you can get past those pesky 12 seeds, the odds are pretty decent that you can make a deep March run. So if that happens, then people aren't going to think about the 10-8 Big 12 record all that much when they look back on the season.
Okay, your predictions for the Cyclones for Sunday?
Well, you know, a whole lot of it comes down to the matchup that they're given. The nice thing is they won't be paired with Northern Iowa since they played in the regular season. But I think that even with Naz Mitrulong gone for the year, that George Niang, who had just an incredible season and went out heroically yesterday against Oklahoma, I think that he's going to be able to carry them to the Sweet 16 and beyond this year.
Okay. Let's talk about the Hawkeyes. Upset by Illinois in the Big Ten tournament yesterday. Wow, they have taken a nosedive in recent days. How did they look yesterday?
They didn't look great. They were down early, and they spent most of the game trying to play catch-up. And fortunately, they had a couple players, Peter Jock and Jared Utsoff, who were capable of trying to push those comebacks. And they erased 11-point deficits twice in the game. But when you're in a win-or-go-home situation and your opponent is hitting their three-pointers, forcing turnovers, playing really inspired basketball, then you can't keep giving them these cushions that you have to work back from. So, that was a bad loss to take. Illinois won't be going to any tournaments this year. There's no reason for a team like Iowa to lose a game like that, except for the last 3 years, Iowa has been pretty abysmal in the Big Ten tournament. So, you know, once we get off the on paper, it looks like a win to, you know, we've seen these guys in these jerseys do this before.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, it's not that much of an upset. It's not that much of a surprise.
Yeah, the Hawkeyes really starting this season on fire. And then what a fizzle, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you wouldn't expect that. You know, this is their second such, I guess you would say, a fizzle in three seasons. It happened in 2014 as well, under almost identical circumstances. But you wouldn't have expected it from this team this year. One, because there are four senior starters, and also Peter Jock is a junior, so he was there for the 2014 team as well. And that's a tough pill for Iowa fans to swallow.
Okay, Adam Jacoby, we'll have to see what their selection is for Sunday, talking about the Hawkeyes, the Cyclones, and the Panthers. Thank you, Adam Jacoby, managing editor of the blog BlackHeartGoldPants.com. And if you don't mind, Adam, in celebration of the Panthers' birth in the NCAA tournament, we're going to go out with a little bit of a Panther fight song. Thank you very much, Adam, for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Have a great day.
You too. Coming up after a short break on this News Buzz edition of River to River, a new Iowa Public Television documentary about women farmers and an Iowa woman who is working to bring a young Afghan woman to Iowa to attend college. The News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this March the 11th, Friday, March the 11th. Spring is coming, and of course that means farmers preparing fields to plant, mainly corn and soybeans, commodities that are grown largely for livestock feed or ethanol. But low corn and soybean prices are pushing some farmers to consider other options. Iowa Public Radio's Amy Mayer has been reporting on the growth of cover crops used in the state. She joins me now, Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Nice to talk with you again, Amy.
Hi there, Ben.
Elaborate a little bit on the shift here. What's pushing farmers to perhaps do things differently?
Well, there's two things going on. One thing is that farmers are increasingly aware that replenishing the nutrients in their soil is very important to future crops And keeping nutrients on the soil rather than letting it wash down into waterways is important both for their own soil and also for the cleanliness of Iowa's waters, especially rivers. So cover crops are something that have been growing in popularity over the past several years, and they can both keep roots in the soil, which prevents soil erosion and holds in nutrients, good for the soil, good for the water. Mm-hmm. But in general, cover crops are only used for those purposes. If someone has livestock, they can graze their livestock on it, but they haven't usually been used as a cash crop.
Mm-hmm. So what crops are farmers thinking about growing now?
There's a wide variety, and farmers are, we should be clear, not going for wholescale change here. But things like oats can be used as a cover crop, but then could also potentially be sold. Right now, there is an oat processor in Cedar Rapids, but farmers in Iowa haven't quite mastered getting exactly what that buyer wants. So oats are used primarily for livestock feed or straw bales for bedding. But some farmers are using wheat as both cover and for sale. And increasingly, some agronomists are looking at other crops. Mary Wiedenheft is an agronomist at Iowa State, and she would like to see more plants that can be used for human consumption to grow as food. And one idea that she's studying is canola.
There's winter canola and spring canola. Winter canola is grown in Oklahoma, Kansas, in southern Illinois, and Indiana. Could we push that envelope north into Iowa? We've also looked at spring canola, which is grown in the Dakotas and Minnesota. Could we push that envelope and move it further south? So when we did that comparison, we found that winter canola was produced more, but also winter canola provides this winter cover that I'm also very interested in. So canola. So there's a market for it. There's a processor in Iowa who's interested in processing canola oil. So why not?
There are a few reasons why not, and she is working on those. The market that she talked about does exist, but the infrastructure for Iowa growers to get it to that market, there's a few pieces there to work out. And she's still working out some of the agronomic questions. And then farmers would need to know that if they shift some land from corn or soybeans for a period of time, will they gain enough benefit that they can feel financially it's a risk worth taking. Mm-hmm. That's partly why the lower corn and soybean prices right now might make them a little more open.
Mm-hmm. And canola, that's in my cupboard, the canola oils.
That's right.
But I guess I don't know where that comes from. Is that what we used to call rapeseed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we could see that being grown more often here in Iowa. Talk a little bit more about the water quality you mentioned at the outset here. We have, of course, this lawsuit between the Des Moines Water Works and three counties in northwest Iowa, the Des Moines Water Works saying they have to put in a lot of investment to clean up water, largely because of non-source pollution from cropland, right?
That's right. And cover crops are one of the recommendations of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, which is that voluntary statewide plan that encourages farmers to take certain measures to hold the nutrients in their soil. Certainly, that's been a part of the push behind the adaptation of cover crops, which now estimates are that about 500,000 acres in Iowa are in cover crops. So they have green on the landscape for longer than just the growing season.
Mm-hmm.
And I think increasingly farmers are recognizing that this isn't just about, you know, saving the Des Moines Water Works money or having healthier water for city folk. This is really about their own drinking water and also the quality of their land and being able to grow the kinds of crops that they want at the levels they want on into the future for other generations.
So help me understand a little bit more about how cover crops help the water quality. So we have perhaps nutrients running off of the soybean, corn fields, and then they would be, before they got to a waterway, they would perhaps run through a strip or a patch of cover crops, and then they would soak up these nutrients and prevent them from going into the waterways.
Well, that's one possibility is strips or buffers, and that does happen and that does help. But cover crops are actually planted on the crop field.
Oh.
They can be seeded in while the corn is standing, for example, or they can be planted later. And so they grow up after the corn or soybeans have been harvested and cover that whole field with the greenery, with those roots going down and keeping nutrients in the land, in that soil, so the nutrients don't flow out. Also sometimes retaining soil moisture and just improving the soil organic matter. And in some cases, once those crops are killed or by the frost or terminated in the spring, all that greenery can just be reincorporated into the soil. So it actually helps on the top and below the surface of the soil.
And very quickly, before we have to go, Amy, I know some people are wondering, we've always asked this question, why aren't more fruits and, well, vegetables grown here in Iowa, right here down the road? Are farmers perhaps going to go in that direction? Would that be an alternative?
I asked a few people this question, and it tends to be that people who are in row crops are looking for crops that can fit into the sort of system they've already got going on. Fruits and vegetable crops are much more labor intensive. There are some people who are adapting a small amount of acreage to something big like watermelons that maybe they can do all at one time. They all sort of are ready for harvest at once. It's a lot of labor for that period of time, but it's not ongoing throughout the season. But it's not a natural fit for someone who has row crops to try to fit in a little bit of, you know, some really intense vegetable or fruit that is going to take a lot more attention and a totally different infrastructure.
Okay. Amy Mayer, agricultural reporter for Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Always nice to have you stop by, Amy.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A couple more conversations to round off our set of quick conversations to end the week on this edition. Farm Her was founded in 2013 in order to try to change the image of agriculture. Photographer Margie Geiler-Alanese is founder and president of the organization called Farm Her. She started taking pictures and collecting stories of women who grow the nation's food, and it's grown into a new documentary about the organization, debuting on Iowa Public Television on Monday, March 14th. Laurel Bauer Berkmeyer is with us, producer and director at IPTV and director of Farm Her, the documentary. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, how are you, Ben?
I'm doing fine. So tell us how this started. How did you discover this Farm Her organization?
Well, we had a colleague of ours, Jennifer Confers, that used to work at Iowa Public Television, is a good friend of Margie Geiler-Alanese, and she suggested that we take a look at it. So I produced a story for our Market to Market program, and we won an award from the Iowa Broadcast News Association and decided to extend it into a documentary.
Mm-hmm. What makes this so interesting for you as a documentary filmmaker?
Well, I focused a lot with documentaries on rural America, rural Iowa, and so it was a natural fit for me. And being a woman myself, I really found Margie's work, really interesting. I think that it's great to pay attention to women. I mean, they've been farming and part of agriculture since the beginning of time, but she's really helped put them in the forefront.
Mm-hmm. And also, female farmers, let's face it, often don't get the credit they're due.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, a lot of times when you see imagery of agriculture, you just don't see women in that. And Margie and our documentary helped change that.
So how many women do we meet in this documentary?
You meet seven women along with Margie. We tell Margie's story, but we meet women from Montana, Wisconsin, Iowa, Florida, and Texas.
Okay. And two Iowans in this documentary want to hear from one of them. Let's meet Pam. She's a farmer of row crops, also a farm advocate. Let's listen to a little bit of her from your documentary.
My life seems about like perfect now. It's controlled chaos, but I've always wanted to be able to give back. So sometimes being a woman on the farm can be pretty isolating. And I had noticed there, at the time when I was a young farmer, there weren't a lot of role models and mentors out there. But I happened to see in the Farm Bureau spokesman, there was a woman that was my age, and she'd gotten involved and was working on some legislative things and was on a trip to London. And that just kind of planted the seed in the back of my mind, and I thought, you know, that might be something I'd like to do someday.
Hmm. What was it like to visit Pam's farm?
It was great. Pam and her husband and then their two sons along with their wives plant corn and soybeans. And Pam has long been a part of the farming operation. But I think her best characteristic is that she really is an advocate for agriculture. She travels around the world advocating for agriculture and being on several different boards working with the USDA. So she's a terrific example of a strong woman that's involved in agriculture today.
One of the other Iowa
farmers you feature, interestingly, much different than Pam, a woman who immigrated to the United States from Rwanda in Africa as a refugee, a woman named Angelique. Tell us about her background.
Yeah, Angelique is another great story. She works with Lutheran Services of Iowa with their Global Greens Farm, and she has a plot of land. But she has several different jobs, but farming is her passion. And, you know, coming as a refugee, she's lost many family members in her native land because of war. And I think she's just a very uplifting story, someone who is following her passion despite what she's been through and working several different jobs to be able to farm and hopefully can do that full time someday.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite part of this documentary?
You know, I really don't. I mean, we traveled all across the country. That was a lot of fun, and seeing several different types of agriculture. The women are all very diverse in age and ethnicity, in what they do. So really, I don't have a favorite. I enjoyed each and every one of them, and I would love to work with them again. And Margie Geiler-Alaniz, the photographer, is terrific. We've worked together now twice. And so, you know, I really don't have a favorite. I think it's just something that helps us appreciate women in agriculture, and I hope that's what people get from it.
Okay, thank you very much. Laurel Bauer-Bergmeier, producer and director at IPTV, director of Farm Her, the documentary. And Laurel, people can find out that there are several viewings of this available in the next few days.
Yeah, it'll be on Monday, March 14th at 8 p.m., Friday, March 18th at 8:30 p.m., and Sunday, March 20th at 12 p.m. And they can also go to IPTV.org to find out more information about the documentary.
Okay, Laurel Bauer-Bergmeier, thank you very much. As always, as Laurel mentioned, go to IPTV.org to find out more. Thanks, Laurel.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Finally, today on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio, we meet Emily Roberts, a young Iowa woman, a small business owner, as a matter of fact, also an undergraduate student at the University of Iowa. She's working to bring a young woman living in Afghanistan here to Iowa to attend college. She joins me in our Iowa City studio now. Hi, Emily.
Ben, thank you so much for having me.
This young woman is, I believe, if I'm remembering right, 19 years old?
19.
Sultana is her name. How did you meet?
So we met on an online Skype-based language exchange program. And from the first time we met, we just became really good friends, and it's kind of escalated from there.
Uh-huh. So you were teaching her English, helping her out with her English?
Yeah, I was interested in learning some new languages, so I just got on there. I saw that she had a profile, and I've done a lot of English teaching. And so, yeah, we just started having conversation, and it was really great.
When was the first time you spoke with her? How long ago?
I think it was late September, early October.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's been a long – and you speak with her every day?
I speak with her, yeah, almost every day. Now we've sort of dropped my language learning part, and we just chat and talk and our friends.
Okay. So tell us about this idea of bringing Sultana to the United States, specifically to Iowa, specific more to the University of Iowa – to study. How did this idea pop out of this relationship that you've started?
Yeah, so Sultana and I were talking, and I was asking her conversation questions to help her practice her English. And one of the first questions I asked her was, you know, what is a perfect day for you? What would a perfect day be like? And she said, well, I would wake up really early, and I would study physics and calculus all day.
Wow.
And I was thinking, wow, that sounds like a terrible day for me. but it really sounded to me like she needed to, you know, pursue higher education. So I learned a lot about her educational journey. And she said, do you think it's even possible for me to go to, you know, a school in the States or elsewhere? And I said, I don't know, but we're going to find out. And we've been on that journey together ever
since. So you've been doing research about what it would take to have her come to the United States?
Well, so that journey started with the research basically was to figure out what she needed to get into a school. And because she doesn't have high school transcripts, she lost her access to education at the age of 11 when men basically showed up at her door and threatened her father that if they continued to send her to school, they would do something like burn her face with acid. And they made a lot of threats. And so she lost access to education. At 13, she started educating herself. So because she doesn't have high school transcripts, it becomes very complicated to get her into a U.S. institution.
Mm-hmm. We have a little bit of your Skype conversation recorded from her recent part of this Skype conversation. You mentioned the position of women in this society, really disadvantaged, especially when it comes to education. Let's listen to a little bit of the conversation that you had with your Afghanistan friend, Sultana, the Emily Roberts speaking with Sultana. Let's listen in for a few seconds.
And because I was a female, we were treated differently. And a school or teacher told us that you should go home and do household chores while you're coming to school.
So your own teacher was asking you, why are you coming to school?
Yeah.
Like, what kinds of things did he teach you then, if that was his belief that you shouldn't learn?
In school, I just learned how to write and read in Pashto. That's all. On a basic level, that's all I learned.
Did you learn anything, you know, like math or any other, no other subjects?
No. In our school, our teacher beat us for incorrect answers, hanging out outside after the break. One day I was looking for my sister and cousin outside after break time. After the break time was finished, so our teacher, our principal, saw me and beat me and then threw me onto the floor.
Oh my gosh.
And this is something I still, when I remember, I still feel my eyes get red.
Sultana speaking with my guest, Emily Roberts. Sultana in Afghanistan, and Emily's trying to help her to attend the University of Iowa at some point in the future. Sounds like there were probably a lot of emotional conversations there, Emily Roberts, when she talks about her eyes still being red from being beaten at school, being asked by her own teacher why should she even attend school.
Yeah, it you know, what's incredible to me is that kind of behavior is not uncommon, particularly in her region of Afghanistan and Kandahar. It's an especially conservative region, and so women's education is not encouraged in mm-hmm. those areas.
Women in society there is past education. Women in general are to be hidden. Is that right?
Yeah.
How is that enforced? Did you ever talk with her about that?
That's correct, yeah. So there's a lot of sort of formal and informal enforcing of those rules. So first of all, if she goes out, she does have to be in burqa, fully covered from head to toe. She is still, even then, sort of ridiculed and teased about being outside of the house. She's told me about this phrase that they have that basically says, the translation is, the women's place is in the home or in the grave. And, you know, the first time I heard that, I was like, oh, my gosh.
And there are examples of women who try to defy that who do end in the grave.
Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Correct.
So what you mentioned her interest in what, physics and calculus. Have you talked with Sultana about her career aspirations?
Yeah. Sultana wants to study. She loves dark matter. She's intrigued by dark matter. She calls it the world's biggest mystery. And she wants to solve that enigma is the word she used. And she was very excited to get an opportunity to speak via Skype with a very famous physicist, Lawrence Krauss, in December. And so I think that really got her even more excited about studying physics and specifically dark matter.
Mm-hmm. So how are you helping her achieve? You mentioned, so I imagine you have to work with visa and a visa application, student visa. How many hurdles, what kind of hurdles are there in getting Sultana to come here to the United States?
Yeah, her journey has been just absolutely insane. First of all, there's no testing. She relies on testing because she doesn't have, you know, transcripts, high school transcripts, and there's no ACT or SAT testing centers in Afghanistan. So she also can't go anywhere without an approved male relative. So she had to apply for a passport. Several weeks after that, she found out her uncle was going on a business trip. He was able to take her to Pakistan. It was about a 20-hour journey, not including the border crossing to Pakistan. She was there for several months waiting to take the SAT. Mm. By the time she got there, the wait list, she had to be on a wait list because the test was already full. People from College Board helped get her off that wait list. And, every step of the journey has just had an incredible amount of difficulty for
and
her.
And it brings to mind how privileged we are here to be able to have a, you know, public university available And then you probably look around at your classmates. You said you're an undergraduate and say, oh, you know, people groaning about having to get up to go to class.
Yeah.
Gives you a different perspective.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. So how can people find out more about Sultana and perhaps finding out more about how she could come to the United States to study?
Yeah, so she has two final steps of her journey, and one is being able to prove the funding, that she has enough funding to go to school here. Iowa is a need-blind school, so she has to raise $40,000 to be able to prove that she can come. So we've set up a GoFundMe page for her. That's GoFundMe.com/Sultana. And then the final step will be to go ahead and get that visa once she gets her I-20.
Have you spoken with University of Iowa officials about this?
I've been in constant contact with the admissions office, and they're looking forward. They said her SAT scores and her IELTS scores were high enough to get into the university, so that was really
exciting. Looks positive. We may be checking back with you in the future with hopefully a happy outcome. We'll put that website also on our website, iowapublicradio.org. Thank you very much, Emily Roberts, for telling the story and helping out this young woman in Afghanistan.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great sunny weekend, hopefully.